This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of ankylosing spondylitis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Ankylosing spondylitis is a chronic seronegative autoimmune spondyloarthropathy characterized by bridging spinal osteophyte formation, enthesitis, sacroiliitis, and uveitis. Diagnosis is made with the presence of HLA-B27 antigens, the presence of bilateral sacroiliitis, and ocular examination to assess for uveitis. Treatment is observation, NSAIDs, and physical therapy for mild symptoms. Surgical management is indicated for unstable spinal fractures, progressive deformity, and the presence of neurological deficits. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, as far as the incidence of ankylosing spondylitis, this condition affects approximately 0.2% of the Caucasian population. In terms of demographics, there is a 4-to-1 male-to-female ratio, and usually presents in the third decade of life. The juvenile form in patients less than 16 years old includes enthesitis. Note that fewer than 10% of HLA-B27 positive patients have symptoms of ankylosing spondylitis. Moving on to etiology, in terms of pathoanatomy, the exact mechanism of ankylosing spondylitis is unknown, but is most likely due to an autoimmune reaction to an environmental pathogen in a genetically susceptible individual. Theories of relation to HLA-B27 include HLA-B27 aggregates with peptides in the joint and leads to a degenerative cascade. Another theory involves cytotoxic T-cell autoimmune reaction against HLA-B27. With respect to enthesitis, note that enthesis inflammation leads to bony erosion, surrounding soft tissue ossification, and eventually joint ankylosis. This preferentially targets sacroiliac joints, spinal apophyseal joints, and the symphysis pubis. This differentiates from rheumatoid arthritis, which is a synovial process. In terms of disc space involvement, inflammation of the annulus leads to bridging osteophyte formation, otherwise known as syndesmophytes. In terms of genetics, there is a genetic predisposition to ankylosing spondylitis, but the mode of inheritance is unknown. Remember that HLA-B27 is located on the 6th chromosome in the B locus. Diagnostic criteria for ankylosing spondylitis includes bilateral sacroiliitis, plus or minus uveitis, and HLA-B27 positive, and know that 90% are positive. Systemic manifestations of ankylosing spondylitis include acute anterior uveitis and iritis, heart disease like cardiac conduction abnormalities, pulmonary fibrosis, renal amyloidosis, ascending aortic conditions like aortitis, stenosis, and regurgitation, and Klebsiella pneumoniae synovitis, where HLA-B27 individuals are more susceptible to Klebsiella pneumoniae synovitis. Orthopedic manifestations of ankylosing spondylitis include bilateral sacroiliitis, progressive spinal kyphotic deformity, cervical spine fractures, and large joint arthritis, specifically the hip and shoulder. Moving on to relevant anatomy, the enthesis is defined as the insertion of tendon, ligaments, or muscle into bone. Moving on to the presentation of ankylosing spondylitis, symptoms can include lumbosacral pain and stiffness, neck and upper thoracic pain, sciatic nerve pain, loss of horizontal gaze, and shortness of breath. So in the setting of lumbosacral pain and stiffness, this is present in most patients with ankylosing spondylitis, and is typically worse in the morning, and has an insidious onset in the third decade of life. Neck and upper thoracic pain occurs later in life, and note that acute neck pain should raise suspicion for a fracture. Note that sciatic nerve pain likely originates from sciatic nerve involvement in the pelvis, otherwise known as piriformis spasm. In terms of shortness of breath, this may be caused by costovertebral joint involvement, leading to reduced chest expansion. Moving on to physical exam, findings may include limitation of chest wall expansion, and note that less than 2 centimeters of expansion is more specific than HLA-B27 for making the diagnosis. Decreased spine motion is known as the Schobert test, which is used to evaluate lumbar stiffness. Another finding on physical exam may be decreased spine motion, and the Schobert test is used to evaluate lumbar stiffness. Another potential finding on physical exam is a kyphotic spine deformity, specifically a chin-on-chest or flexion deformity of the spine, that may be caused by multiple microfractures that occur over time. Note that the chin-brown to vertical angle, or CBVA, is measured from a standing exam of the standing lateral radiograph, and is useful for preoperative planning. Correction of this angle correlates with improved surgical outcomes. Hip flexion contracture is another potential finding on physical exam, and examining the patient in the supine and sitting position helps differentiate sagittal plane imbalance due to hip flexion contractures or kyphotic spinal deformity. Finally, physical exam should also include sacroiliac provocative tests like the Faber test, which is flexion, adduction, and external rotation of the ipsilateral hip, which causes pain. Moving on to imaging, Recommended views on radiographs for the spine include a standing full-length AP and lateral of the axial spine. Findings are negative in 50% of cases with spine fractures, squaring of the vertebrae with vertical or marginal syndesmophyse, and late vertebral scalloping, otherwise known as a bamboo spine. Measurements include a chin-brow to vertical angle, which is used to measure a chin-on-chest deformity and is useful for preoperative planning for osteotomy. Recommended views for the pelvis and lower extremity include a Ferguson pelvic tilt view, which allows for improved visualization of the anterior SI joint, and the X-ray beam is directed 10 to 15 degrees cephalad. Findings include bilateral symmetric sacroiliac erosion, and the earliest radiographic sign is erosion of the iliac side of the sacroiliac joint. Other findings include joint space narrowing and ankylosis. A CT scan will show bony changes but not active inflammation. Know that a CT is the most sensitive test to diagnose cervical fractures in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. Remember that the entire spinal axis should be imaged in patients presenting with trivial trauma. An MRI will detect inflammation, making it the best modality for early detection of ankylosing spondylitis in young patients. Be sure to obtain an MRI with cervical fractures to look for epidural hemorrhage. Finally, a bone scan will show inflammation in the sacroiliac joints, but lack specificity. As far as studies to obtain in the workup of ankylosing spondylitis, labs have little diagnostic value, as you will often see nonspecific elevations in ESR and CRP. Rheumatoid factor, or RF, is typically negative, and therefore ankylosing spondylitis is referred to as a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. In terms of diagnostic injections, an SI joint injection is a local anesthetic injected into the SI joint under fluoroscopic guidance and is often the most sensitive diagnostic test. Now let's go over the differential diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis. Specifically, we'll go over the differences between diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, or DISH, with ankylosing spondylitis. So with respect to syndesmophytes, in DISH, these will be non-marginal, while in ankylosing spondylitis, syndesmophytes will be marginal. Radiographs in the setting of DISH are referred to as, quote, flowing candle wax, while in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis, you will see what's known as a, quote, bamboo spine, squaring of the vertebral bodies, quote, shiny corners at the attachment of the annulus fibrosus, otherwise known as Romanus lesions. In terms of the disc space, in the setting of DISH, there will be preservation of the disc space, while in ankylosing spondylitis, the cervical spine will show ossification of the disc space. With respect to osteopenia, DISH will have no osteopenia, rather there may be increased radiodensity, while in ankylosing spondylitis, osteopenia will be present. With respect to HLA, in the setting of DISH, there is no evidence of association with HLA-B27. However, it is associated with HLA-B8, which is common in patients with DISH and diabetes. HLA in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis will have a strong association with HLA-B27. In terms of age group, DISH is typically seen in older patients or middle-aged patients, while ankylosing spondylitis is seen in younger patients. In terms of SI joint involvement, DISH will have no involvement, and actually SI joint abnormality generally excludes the diagnosis of DISH, while ankylosing spondylitis will typically have bilateral sacroiliitis. Finally, with respect to diabetes, this is typically associated with DISH and is not typically associated with ankylosing spondylitis. General treatment for ankylosing spondylitis can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes NSAIDs, COX-2 inhibitors, and therapy, which is indicated as the first line of treatment for pain and stiffness. Note that oral steroids are not recommended. As far as the techniques of non-operative management, physical therapy should focus on maintaining flexibility. TNF-alpha blocking agents are indicated as the second line of medical management. Specific medications include infliximab, etanercept, and adalimumab. As far as outcomes, clinical studies show significant improvements in severity of symptoms. Now, let's quickly talk about spine trauma in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis. As a quick introduction, most spine trauma in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis occurs in the mid-cervical and cervicothoracic junction, however some occur at the thoracolumbar junction. In terms of pathoanatomy, spine trauma is often an extension-type fracture that involves all three columns. In terms of prognosis, there's a high mortality rate secondary to epidural hemorrhage, and know that there is 75% neurologic involvement. Moving on to presentation, symptoms of ankylosing spondylitis usually presents with pain after a low-energy fall. On physical exam, know that neurologic deficits often present late and therefore patients should be admitted and observed. Moving on to imaging, radiographs may be occult. If you're suspicious, consider a CT scan, which is the best modality to make a diagnosis. Finally, as far as MRI in the setting of spine trauma and ankylosing spondylitis, know that a high mortality rate is secondary to epidural hemorrhage, so obtaining an MRI is important. As far as treatment of spine trauma in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis, this can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes immobilizing in the existing kyphotic position and admitting for observation and advanced imaging. Indications include stable spine fractures with no neurologic deficits. As far as the technique, know that low weight traction may facilitate reduction. Operative options include spinal decompression with instrumented fusion. This is indicated in the setting of a progressive neurologic deficit, epidural hematoma with neurologic compromise, and unstable fracture patterns. The technique involves decompression and instrumentation. In terms of decompression, the decision to go anterior or posterior depends on fracture level, presence and location of hematoma, and osteoporosis. As far as instrumentation, you need to obtain a long fusion construct. Multiple points of fixation above and below the fracture are necessary because of osteoporosis and the long lever arms of the ankylosed spine. Remember, do not make an effort to correct the deformity. In terms of outcomes and complications, there is a high rate of complications in these patients, including progressive deformity, non-union, hardware failure, and infection. Moving on to spinal deformity in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis, as a quick introduction, this is usually a kyphotic deformity of the upper spine. Be sure to eliminate hip contractures as a reason for deformity. As far as treatment of spinal deformity in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis, a lumbar osteotomy can be indicated in the setting of a thoracolumbar kyphotic deformity. The goal is to restore sagittal balance and horizontal gaze. Techniques include a closing wedge pedicle subtracting osteotomy, vertebral body resection, single level opening wedge osteotomy, and multi-segment opening osteotomy. So starting with closing wedge or a pedicle subtracting osteotomy, this is a transpedicular decancellation procedure with removal of the posterior elements. Note that the location of the osteotomy is determined by the type of spine flexion deformity, the hinge is located on the anterior vertebral body, and is considered the procedure of choice due to greater deformity correction, that is 30 to 40 degrees per level, and know that better fusion and stability is due to direct bony apposition. In terms of vertebral body resection, know that the entire vertebral body is removed and replaced with a cage. A single-level opening wedge osteotomy hinges on the posterior edge of the vertebral body and requires rupture of the anterior longitudinal ligament. Finally, a multi-segment opening osteotomy has the advantage of less bone loss and preservation of the ALL by distributing correction over multiple levels. As far as outcomes and complications, know that the lumbar approach avoids complications of a thoracic cage, spinal cord injury, and has potential for greater correction due to the long lever arm. Moving on to C7 to T1 cervical thoracic osteotomy, this is indicated for cervical thoracic kyphotic or a chin-on-chest deformity. The goal is slight undercorrection with a final brow-to-chin angle of 10 degrees. The technique involves an osteotomy and instrumentation. In terms of osteotomy, the advantage of a C7 to T1 osteotomy include that the vertebral artery is external to the transverse foramen and there's a larger canal diameter. This osteotomy requires a wide decompression with removal of the C7 lateral mass and portions of C7 to T1 pedicles to prevent iatrogenic spinal cord injury. As far as instrumentation, this is usually a combination of lateral mass screws, pedicle screws, and sublaminar hooks. Postoperatively, a postoperative halo immobilization is often required in patients with poor bone quality. In terms of outcomes and complications, there is an increased risk of venous air embolus in the sitting operative position. Now, let's finish this review session talking about large joint arthritis in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis. As a quick introduction, know that there is asymmetric involvement of large joints in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis, and the shoulder and hip are most commonly involved. Treatment includes total hip replacement and bilateral total hip arthroplasty. Indications of total hip replacement is in patients with severe arthritis of the hips secondary to ankylosing spondylitis. With respect to technique, these patients have more vertical and antiverted acetabulum and may lead to anterior dislocations after total hip arthroplasty. With respect to bilateral total hip arthroplasty, this is indicated in the setting of kyphotic deformity due to hip flexion contractor deformity. As far as outcomes and complications, these patients are at risk for dislocation for the reasons that we just mentioned. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. A 36-year-old presents to the emergency department with upper back and neck pain after being rear-ended by another vehicle. The patient's past medical history is significant for ankylosing spondylitis, for which he takes etanercept. On physical exam, he has tenderness to the cervical spine posteriorly, walks with a normal gait, and is neurovascularly intact to the bilateral upper and lower extremities. AP and lateral radiographs of the cervical and thoracic spines show squaring of the vertebral bodies but are otherwise unremarkable. What is the best next step? and the choices are 1, flexion extension radiographs of the cervical spine, 2, CT cervical, thoracic, and lumbar spines, 3, soft cervical collar, 4, outpatient follow-up with repeat radiographs in 7 to 10 days, 5, NSAIDs and physical therapy evaluation. The correct answer to this question is 2, CT, cervical, thoracic, and lumbar spines. So patients with ankylosing spondylitis are at high risk for having spinal fractures and spinal cord injuries even after low-energy accidents. Advanced imaging of the entire spine is recommended, as up to 50% of these fractures are missed on plain films. Patients with ankylosing spondylitis are at increased risk for developing spinal fractures even without a history of trauma. The creation of bridging syndesmophytes, which give the spine its characteristic, quote, bamboo appearance, leads to increased rigidity and long lever arms, making them more susceptible to fracture. Given the abnormal appearance of the spine, these injuries are often missed on plain radiographs. Thus, patients with ankylosing spondylitis who present with neck or back pain should undergo complete evaluation utilizing CT imaging. Lastly, in patients with progressive neurologic deficits, an MRI is warranted, as patients with ankylosing spondylitis are at a higher risk for epidural hemorrhage. Tarag et al. Reviewed the diagnosis and treatment of ankylosing spondylitis and axial spondyloarthritis. They report a spinal fracture rate of 10% in patients with ankylosing spondylitis, given the combination of osteoporosis and spinal rigidity. Furthermore, they outlined the high association of spinal fractures and devastating spinal cord injuries in this subset of patients. They conclude that even in the absence of trauma, the spine should be fully evaluated using CT scans in the setting of new onset neck or back pain. Karen et al. Specifically review spinal fractures in patients with ankylosing spinal disorders. They report that 122 consecutive spinal fractures in patients with ankylosing spondylitis, most were extension type injuries affecting C6 to C7. Concomitant spinal cord injuries were present in 58% of patients in this study. They conclude that patients with ankylosing spondylitis have a high rate of complications and neurologic compromise following spinal fractures and should be counseled accordingly. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, flexion extension radiographs of the cervical spine is incorrect, as flexion extension radiographs in the setting of a likely fracture should not be performed. This patient has an undiagnosed, unstable cervical spine fracture, and flexion extension films could have devastating complications. Answer 3, soft cervical collar is incorrect, as while patients with suspected cervical spine injuries should be immobilized, a rigid cervical orthosis should be used. Finally, answer 4, outpatient follow-up with repeat radiographs in 7 to 10 days, and 5, NSAIDs and physical therapy evaluation are both incorrect, as conservative management and outpatient follow-up are not appropriate prior to ruling out a spinal fracture. Moving on to the next question. A 75-year-old male presents to the ED with posterior neck pain following a ground-level fall. On physical exam, he is tender to palpation along the posterior cervical spine. He is ambulatory and neurologically intact. Radiographs of the cervical spine are negative, except for the finding of marginal syndesmophytes. What is the most appropriate next step in management? And the choices are 1, cervical immobilization, CT of the cervical spine, and x-rays of the thoracic and lumbar spine, 2, placement in a hard collar, NSAIDs, ice, rest, and 1-week outpatient follow-up, 3, flexion extension radiographs of the cervical spine, 4, obtain x-rays of the thoracic and lumbar spine, and 5, MRI of the cervical spine. The correct answer to this question is 1, cervical immobilization, CT of the cervical spine, and x-rays of the thoracic and lumbar spine. So this patient has ankylosing spondylitis and requires immediate cervical immobilization and a CT scan of the cervical spine in order to rule out a fracture, which may not be visible on plain films in up to 50% of cases. Ankylosing spondylitis places patients at an elevated risk for spinal fractures due to a high prevalence of osteoporosis and spinal rigidity attributed to marginal osteophytes, resulting in long lever arms. Even in the absence of trauma, ankylosing spondylitis patients with acute back or neck pain should be assumed to have a fracture until proven otherwise. Special attention should be taken with positioning and transferring these patients, as fractures are often unstable. Due to the long lever arms in these patients, concomitant spinal injuries are not uncommon, and imaging the entire spine is recommended. Due to the difficulty in detecting these fractures alone, CT and/or MRI should be utilized to aid in diagnosis. Weinstein et al. Retrospectively reviewed 105 cases of ankylosing spondylitis. There was a 12% incidence of spinal fractures in this population, 8 of which resulted in paralysis. The authors emphasized the need for accurate radiographic assessment, immobilization, and prompt decompression and fusion when warranted to prevent neurologic injury. Werner et al. Provided a review article on the etiology, diagnosis, and management of spinal fractures and management of spinal fractures in ankylosing spondylitis patients. They note the difficulty in radiographic assessment and stress the use of advanced imaging to pan scan the entire spine. They also note the high complication rates associated with both operative and non-operative management and suggest consideration of both anterior and posterior fixation. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 2, placement in a hard collar, NSAIDs, ice, rest, and 1 week outpatient follow-up is incorrect, as it's inappropriate to discharge a patient with ankylosing spondylitis without obtaining advanced imaging in this setting. Answer 3, flexion extension radiographs of the cervical spine is incorrect, as obtaining flexion extension radiographs in an ankylosing spondylitis patient with a potentially unstable fracture may have catastrophic neurological consequences. Answer 4, obtain x-rays of the thoracic and lumbar spine is incorrect, as while imaging the entire spine is appropriate, the cervical spine should be further investigated with advanced imaging. Finally, answer 5, MRI of the cervical spine is incorrect, as MRI is often combined with CT to diagnose spine fractures in ankylosing spondylitis patients. However, the initial screening modality should be a CT scan of the entire spine. And moving on to the final question. A 48-year-old man is brought in by emergency services after falling down a flight of stairs. He complains of weakness in both hands. Examination reveals weak grip bilaterally. Injury CT scans show a non-displaced shear fracture through the C6 vertebral body and C5 posterior elements in the setting of ankylosing spondylitis. What is the most appropriate treatment option? And the choices are 1, hard cervical orthosis, 2, immobilization in cervical thoraco lumbosacral orthosis, 3, anterior decompression and fusion of C4 to C7, 4, posterior decompression and fusion of C5 to C6, and 5, posterior decompression and fusion of C3 to T2. The correct answer to this question is 5, posterior decompression and fusion of C3 to T2. So this patient has ankylosing spondylitis and has suffered a shear fracture through C5, C6. Due to the presence of neurological deficits, posterior decompression and fusion with a long construct, such as from C3 to T2, is indicated. The C-spine is the most common site of fracture in ankylosing spondylitis and is most susceptible to hyperextension injuries. When surgical intervention is required, multiple points of fixation both above and below the fracture are necessary. This is due to coexisting osteoporosis and abnormally increased forces from long lever arms of the ankylosed spine, both of which make the construct susceptible to failure and screw pullout. Kubiak et al. Reviewed the orthopedic management of ankylosing spondylitis. They report bone scan, MRI or fine-cut CT is necessary because fractures are often missed on plain x-rays because of distortion of anatomy or difficulty with positioning. Wang et al. Reviewed spinal injuries in 12 patients with ankylosing spondylitis and 18 patients with DISH. Most injuries involved C5 to C7. Patients with ankylosing spondylitis were more likely to have severe neurologic injury, as 41% were Asia A, than DISH, where 44% were Asia E. There was 81% good to excellent outcome and 4 deaths related to halo vest use. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, hard cervical orthosis, and answer 2, immobilization and cervical thoraco lumbosacral orthosis are both incorrect, as this is a highly unstable 3-column injury, and surgical stabilization is necessary to prevent further neurologic injury. Answer 3, anterior decompression and fusion of C4 to C7, and 4, posterior decompression and fusion of C5 to C6 are both incorrect, as short segment decompression and fusion is less preferred because of the long lever arms and likelihood of construct failure. Long constructs are best performed through a posterior approach. If there is significant osteoporosis and the risk of construct failure is high, a 360 approach may be necessary. That's all for this review about ankylosing spondylitis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.